Welcome to the Dhamma class. There's quite a lot of people today. We only quickly photocopied 9 copies for those people who haven't got their books. Who wants a copy? Please, if you do, please come up quickly. Come up here. Get a copy of Sutta number 72. First come, first served. 1, 2. There. You can share, it'll be very good. There we go, sorry. No, you have to share. There's not enough. Last one. Okay, yeah. Okay. Another one? Okay. Here you go. Oops, there you go. So usually at the sutta classes, usually give the classes from this book, Middle Length Discourse of the Buddha, available in our library. It's very cheap, very good value for money, simply because you've got some of the best teachings of the Buddha in this one book. And you can actually read and discuss the actual teachings of the Buddha, not the teachings of a monk or a nun who came later, who put it in their own words. This is as close as you can get to the original teachings of the Buddha. So that's why it's fascinating for us to see what the Buddha actually taught. And today we're going to discuss a very interesting sutta. It's the 72nd sutta called the Aggi-Wacha-Gotta Sutta. And the reason I just bring this one up because it's something which is discussed again and again and again. And basically, what happens to you after you become enlightened and you pass away? What happens? And this is the sutta which many people quote, and now we're going to read it out for you. So is everyone getting ready there? Okay. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So this is a teaching to Wacha-Gotta on the fire, the simile of the fire. And if any of you want to actually to read a bit further, you see that Wacha-Gotta was a wanderer. There's 3 suttas all about Wacha-Gotta in this collection. The Threefold Knowledge is beforehand, where it's just giving Wacha-Gotta a bit of faith. And it does seem these will be chronological in order, that this would come afterwards. But this is the main teaching to Wacha-Gotta, and it goes as follows. Thus have I heard, on one occasion a Blessed One was living at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. In the suttas, we always begin with the location of where this teaching was given. And this is wonderful if ever you have an opportunity to go on pilgrimage to India, which many of you do, and actually you go to the Jeta Grove Monastery. And as soon as you go to that monastery and you've been to classes like this, all these teachings come alive. Because you know this was the place where these things happened. And when you've been there, and then you start reading these suttas, Blessed One was living at Sarvati in Jeta Groves, in Jeta's Grove, in Anathapindika's Park. You can visualize exactly where that was. And the whole picture of this beautiful flat area of parkland would actually come to your mind. You can visualize the Buddha sitting there and teaching this wanderer. And this is the record of what was said. Then the wanderer Wacha-Gotta went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When his courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side and asked the Blessed One a question. Again, in the suttas, when you read these again and again and again, you see that the way that he greeted sort of the Buddha meant that he was respectful but not a disciple. There are different ways in which you greet another holy person. And this is the way which you greet somebody. You're not their disciple. You haven't got full faith in them. You're just respectful. And when you know the Pali and you know what these terms mean, you know the acts of courtesy, the protocol in that society, it also gives you an extra meaning of what's happening here. So here's Wacha-Gotta, a wanderer who's obviously got some interest in the wisdom of a Buddha, but is not fully convinced yet. So here's his question. How is it, Master Gotama? Does Master Gotama hold the view the world is eternal, only this is true, anything else is wrong? Vacca, I do not hold of you, the world is eternal, only this is true, anything else is wrong. How then does Master Gotama hold of you, the world is not eternal, only this is true, and everything else is wrong. Vacca, I do not hold of you, the world is not eternal, only this is true, anything else is wrong. How is it, Master Gotama? Does Master Gotama hold of you? The world is finite, only this is true, anything else is wrong. Vacca, I do not hold of you. The world is finite, only this is true, anything else is wrong. How then does Master Gotama hold of you? The world is infinite, only this is true, anything else is wrong. Vacca, I do not hold of you. The world is infinite, only this is true, anything else is wrong. How then is it, Master Gotama? Does Master Gotama hold of you, the soul and the body are the same, only this is true, anything else is wrong? No. How then does Master Gotama hold of you, the soul is one thing and the body another, only this is true, anything else is wrong? No. How is it, Master Gotama? Does Master Gotama hold of you after death, a Tathagata, a Buddha, exists, only this is true, anything else is wrong? Vacca, I do not hold of you, after death, a Tathagata exists, only this is true, anything else is wrong. How then does Master Gotama hold of you, after death a Tathagata does not exist, only this is true, anything else is wrong? Vacca, I do not hold of you, after death a Buddha does not exist, only this is true, anything else is wrong. How is it, Master Gotama? Does Master Gotama hold of you, after death a Buddha both exists and doesn't exist? I know, said the Buddha. How then does Master Gotama hold the view, after death, a Buddha neither exists nor does not exist, only this is true, anything else is wrong? Vacca, I do not hold the view, after death, a Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist, only this is true, anything else is wrong. How is it then, Master Gotama? When Master Gotama is asked each of these 10 questions, he replies, I do not hold that view. What danger, what problem does Master Gotama see that he does not take up any of these views? The speculative view is actually added by the commentator, by the translator there. And Gotama asks, Vacca, that particular view that the world is eternal is a thicket of views, a wilderness of views, a contortion or a wriggling of views, a vacillation of views, a fetter of views. It is beset by suffering, by vexation, by despair and by fever, and it does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nirvana. And the same with all those other views. Then does Master Gotama hold out any speculative view at all? Now, before we go on to that, we see what's actually happening here. This is almost like a catechism of 10 views, 10 philosophies, which many people in that time were going around arguing, seeing who holds what position and what. And Master Gotama, the Buddha, said he doesn't believe in any of that. Now let's examine what those views are and what it really means. When he says the world is eternal or not eternal, in other words, you know, does sometimes time end? Or does this go on forever and ever and ever and ever? Or is there some sort of end of the world, like an Armageddon, an end of time? And obviously that we have those two views even in today. Some people said that one day that time will end. They don't actually say what will happen afterwards. But, you know, the time will end sometime. It will be the end of the world. Like a temporal end. And some people say it just goes on forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. And the Buddha said he doesn't believe in either of those views. Which is a bit hard for someone like Vacca to take. It must be one or the other. The same with, is the world infinite or finite? And again, Master Gotama says, I'm not going to answer that, it's neither. Actually, that in science, in physics, there's a great answer to that. And it's the same as like the simile of like, you know, is the area of a sphere finite or infinite? If you look at a body, they've got an area for the surface of a sphere, but it's not bounded, because you can go round and round and round and round as many times as you like. And this is the same as actually the space-time, which we call our universe. It's part of science, general relativity. Whatever direction you go, if you go in a straight line for long enough, you'll come back right where you started. Because the three-dimensional space is actually bent in the fourth dimension. But it's finite, in its volume, but it's got no boundaries. If you get your head around that, then you understand general relativity by Einstein. But it similarly is like an ant on a sphere. Ants are like a football. It goes round and round and round, looking for the end, but can never find it. Because there is no boundary for an ant walking on a football. But the area is finite, but it's no boundaries. Get the message? Okay. So maybe that's the same with time as well. Is it is the world eternal or not eternal? When it says not eternal, it also means that it start from a place. Was there a beginning of time, not just an end of time? And of course, many philosophy says, yes, there was a beginning of time, and they call it the creation. But the Buddha's not buying into that. He said, no, there's no beginning of time, because you can't say it's an infinite either. One of the reasons is because we create time. Yes. How can it be if there's no beginning and no end? It's the same as how can we have like the area of a sphere finite, but you can walk forever without boundaries. What is actually happening here is we're getting a wrong paradigm, a wrong way of looking at things. We need just to stretch our imagination. When we're locked into one particular type of perception, we just can't see further than that. And it's actually the limit of our perceptual experience gives us these so-called paradoxes. When you're looking in another way, you find the paradox is solved. So the paradoxes of these questions, the Buddha's not answering them because both are wrong, they both are not seeing the proper picture. And that's an important point which comes up later on the most important questions about what happens to a Buddha after they die. Which is the whole purpose of me teaching this sutta, because somebody asked me about it just last night. So when we got the world is eternal, in other words, it's always been, always will be, or did it have a start and an end? The Buddha says both are wrong ways of looking at things. And does the master hold a view the world is infinite or finite? I've done that one. Does the master hold a view the soul and the body are the same? Number 7. That's chapter 7, view number 5. Does the master Gotama hold a view the soul and the body are the same, or the soul and the body are different? And this is obviously one understanding of why he says neither, because if you say that that's the only possibility, it's either the soul is the same as the body, it means when you die, so the soul is destroyed. And if you say the soul and the body are different, when you die, the soul goes off somewhere else. And of course, the Buddha will not answer any of those because he said there is no soul to begin with, just a process. So you can see that each one of these dichotomies is another answer there, which actually will mean that neither of those propositions are correct. Are you clear about that one? If you say the soul is the same as the body, or the soul is different than the body, you're assuming the existence of a soul. The soul is a heart, part of the heart which stops beating. That's not quite true. There was a very good book which somebody got from our monastery some time ago. It's a fascinating little book of stories of people who had heart transplants. If you had a heart transplant, now we always thought, when the first heart transplant, who would you wake up as? The owner of the rest of the body or the owner of the heart? Because lots of people thought the soul was in the heart, and therefore if you take someone's heart and give it to somebody else, the soul will go with them. Now, what actually happened was, obviously, you are the person who owns the rest of the body, but there's been a few cases where there has been something from the previous person has lingered in the new person. And one of the most fascinating stories, this is completely by the way, but it's a great story. There was a young girl, I forget which country she was in, Because of some heart disease, she was given a heart transplant, very successful. But when she went home, she started having nightmares. Waking up in the middle of the night, thinking she was being killed. And of course, it repeated itself so many times, the mother took her to the doctor, and the doctor just dismissed it as a result of the trauma of such a very, very heavy operation on a young person. However, the mother just would not buy this, because the details of her dream were so clear. The mother wrote them all down. This young 6 or 7 or 8 year old, I forget how old she was, had this consistent dream of being murdered. And she could recall the street, the place, the time, and so the mother went to the police. And the police were fascinated, because a murder in that place at that time actually happened. And the descriptions which she gave fitted much of what they already knew. But the evidence which they didn't have was the identity of the murderer. And this girl who got the heart of this dead person gave a description. The police, it was one of the suspects, but they couldn't prove anything. And they went to interview this guy and told him what this girl had found out. And he confessed he'd done it. That's actually how they solved that murder. Fascinating. The memory of the murder had somehow lingered in a person's heart. However, what usually happens, they say that those memories only last a certain time and then they sort of disappear and the character of the rest of the body takes over. And the funny story of this, that was the interesting one, the funny story was this, a woman, a very sort of 50, 60-year-old woman who had a heart transplant, and the heart she got happened to be from a young prostitute who had been sort of murdered or killed by something or other, because, you know, these things happen. And the husband actually told the doctor afterwards that once she got home and recovered from her illness, I think the words they used were his 50 or 60-year-old wife, who was usually very prim and proper, now became very frisky. And he was not complaining at all. So the moral of that story is, if you can, if you've got a partner who wants to be rejuvenated, but you know, never mind. But it only lasts for a short time. It's as if somehow the DNA or something, some of the conditioning which is molecular, has actually stays in that sort of heart and sort of infects the rest of the body, only for a while. No, I don't think you can say that some type of consciousness was residual in that heart. I think it's more like the consciousness of the previous person actually that has an imprint in the body. And that imprint of the body sort of persists for a while. And that, in turn, is a feedback mechanism, influences the consciousness after the operation. But only for a while. And then it's sort of the ordinary consciousness sort of settles itself back into its normal way. I don't know if it's an old photo. Oh, residual, yeah. Okay, something, I'm not quite sure if I understand the symbol to repeat it here, but certainly that's the evidence there, but it's not that the soul lives in the heart or anywhere else. Yeah, but the point of that dichotomy there, is the soul part of the body, which means when you die that would be the end of things, or is the soul sort of separate from the body, so it goes off to some heaven afterwards? That is the materialist and the theist view, if you like. And the Buddha is actually another view, completely different than that, you know, of a sort of stream of consciousness. So there is no soul, but there's a stream of consciousness which we take to be our being. So this is why the Buddha would not answer this, because there's a third option. Both are wrong. It's not the case that the Buddha didn't want to answer. They're just, vacillating. You know, that I'm not going to answer any question, therefore you know, like a politician, you can't pin me down. So that's not the point there. The point was that both questions were wrong, and there was another answer, a better answer, a clearer answer. And now we have the four views about what happens to a Buddha after they die. does a Tathagata exist after death or not exist? Or, you know, those are the main ones. They exist or they don't exist. But then people, even at those days, were so subtle, they started thinking it both exists and doesn't exist. Whatever that means, but it sounds mystical. And then they also found an even more mystical way of saying it, neither exists nor does it not exist. Again, whatever that means, but it sounds really neat, doesn't it? So it makes people think, because they don't understand it, it sounds mystical. And whatever you don't understand, which sounds mystical, many people think of as profound. You get a long way in this world, in spiritual charlatanism, if you manage to say a few things like that, which no one really understands, but sounds really good. And people think, well, wow, that guy knows what he's talking about. It sounds really nice. But, of course, this is actually not what real Buddhism is. Now, one of those words is like the ground of all being. What the hell does that mean, the ground of all being? But it sounds good. But anyhow, let's go back to... Sorry? The ground... The grounds of coffee, I know the grounds of coffee. Anyway, come, let's go back to this thing. So those are the four possibilities. Now, why didn't the Buddha actually answer those? Surely that actually covers everything. Either you exist after death, or you don't exist after death, or you both exist and don't exist, or you neither exist nor not exist. Now, the solution to that is... When I say exist, I sometimes actually do a new translation there of that word, which is quite valid, and it actually makes it quite clear what this means. Instead of exist, I've called persist. There's something persisting after death. And that's actually what it really means here. And that makes it very, very clear. If you say, does the Buddha persist after death, or not persist after death? Both persist and not persist. Neither persist nor not persist. And what that does, and the reason why the Buddha didn't answer, and it's quite clear in another sutra I'll read it afterwards, because there's no Buddha to begin with, you can't say that a Buddha persists afterwards. Because there was nothing to begin with, there will be nothing afterwards. But you can't say it persists, because to being persisting after death was saying there's something here right now. And yes, I'll just... To make it quite clear, I'm going to read out now from the Kanda Sangyutta, which answers this very, very clearly. Because this question was asked many, many times. This is from the Kanda Sangyutta, Sutta 86. It is Anuradha. Okay. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Vaisali in the great wood in the hall of the peak roof. That's where they have the lion capital in India right now. Now, on that occasion, the Venerable Anuradha was dwelling in a forest hut not far from the Blessed One, and a number of wanderers of other sects approached the Venerable Anuradha and exchanged greetings with him. When they had concluded their greetings and cordial talk, they sat down to one side and said to him, "Friend, Anuradha, when a Tathagata, a Buddha, is describing a Tathagata, the highest type of person, the supreme person, the attainer of the supreme attainment, they describe him in terms of these four cases. The Tathagata exists after death, or does not exist after death, or both exists and does not exist, or neither exists nor does not exist after death." When this was said, the Venerable Anuradha said to his wanderers, "Friends, when the Buddha is describing the Buddha, the highest type of person, the supreme person, the attainer of the supreme attainment, he describes him apart from these four cases, either existing after death, or does not exist after death, or both exists and does not exist, or neither exists nor does not exist." When this was said, those wanderers said to the Venerable Anuradha, "This monk must be newly ordained, not long gone forth, or, if he's an elder, he must be an incompetent fool." They didn't mince words in those days. Then those wanderers of other sects, having denigrated the Venerable Anuradha with the terms newly ordained and fool, rose from their seats and departed. So Venerable Anuradha went to the Buddha and told him what had happened and asked if those wanderers of other sects should question me further, how should I answer? And so this is how the Buddha explained the answer to this question. "What do you think, Anuradha? is form. This is a first kanda, your body, basically. Is it permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Venerable Sir. And what is impermanent? Oh, this is some dot, dot, dots. This is... Please excuse me. Okay. Where... It's... Okay, I just have to say. Maybe it comes from the front here. Is what is impermanent? Is it suffering or is it happiness? It is suffering, Venerable Sir. What is suffering and impermanent, subject to change? Is that fit to be seen as me, mine, or a self? No. So he understands this and becomes enlightened, and there is no more for this state of being. What do you think, Aniruddha? Do you regard the form as a Tathagata, and now the body as a Buddha? No, Venerable Sir. Do you regard feeling, Vedana, as a Tathagata? No, Venerable Sir. Do you regard perception as a Buddha? No, Venerable Sir. Do you regard volitional formations, such as will, thinking, as a Buddha? Is that what a Buddha is? No, Venerable Sir. Do you regard consciousness as a Tathagata, as a Buddha? No, Venerable Sir. So we've gone through each of the five khandhas. Is that what a Buddha is? Remember, this also includes the volitional formations, includes will, the doer, the chooser, the one behind all of this, the one which motivates you. That's included in the fourth, volitional formations. That's why it's called volitional formations. So do you regard that as a Buddha? You know, the one who does all these great talks? No, he's seen through that. Consciousness, the knowing, is that the Buddha? No. What do you think, Anuradha? Do you regard the Tathagata as in this body, somehow contained inside? No, Venerable Sir. Do you regard the Tathagata as apart from this body? No, Venerable Sir. Do you regard the Tathagata as in the feelings, as in sort of the pleasure and pain? No. Do you regard him as apart from the pleasure and pain, as if that's bigger and greater? No, Venerable Sir. As in perception, as apart from perception, as in volitional formation such as will, is it somehow inside of that, or is it outside of that, somehow owning it? No, Venerable Sir. Do you regard the Buddha as in consciousness, like contained inside of it somehow? No, Venerable Sir. Do you regard the Buddha as apart from the knowing? No, Venerable Sir. What do you think, Anuradha? Do you regard all these things together as a Buddha? No, Venerable Sir. What do you think, Anuradha? Do you regard the Buddha as one who is outside of form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, consciousness? No, Venerable Sir. Now, this is the answer to the big question. But, Anuradha, when a Buddha can't be seen by you as real and actual here in this very life, is it fitting for you to declare friends when a Tathagata is describing a Tathagata, you're describing in one of these four ways, as persists after death, doesn't persist after death, both persist and not persist, neither persist nor not persist? No, Venerable Sir. Good, good, Anuradha. Formerly, Anuradha, and also now, I just make known suffering and the end of suffering. End of sutta. And there is one of the clearest, there's many other sections in the Kanda Sanyutta, of why the Buddha could not answer those questions, because every one of the questions was flawed. You can't see a Buddha in the five khandhas, apart from the five khandhas. There's no Buddha here, just the five khandhas. So as the Buddha said here, suffering arising, suffering ceasing. That was the reason why. That's why that I like to use the word persist instead of exist. So does a Buddha persist after death or not persist after death? There's not one here now, so you can't say it persists or not persists. You can't say it both persists and not persists. You can't say it doesn't persist nor not persists. And there's another simile coming later in the sutta which makes it even clearer.
Yeah.
Yeah, correct, yes. Many parts, yes. Occurs again and again and again and again. Which is very important to actually to know, because it's a very clear understanding of what's happening. Remember, this is almost like, it's a very relevant, it's not sort of something which is not relevant to our discussions of religion and spirituality and truth these days. Because many religions are founded on the idea that there'll be an end of the world or an end of time. And other people who say that it's going to go on forever, doesn't really matter. They might say the soul is the same as the body. In other words, that when you die, that's the end of it. That's a materialist idea. And that is held by many people today, and it really informs the way they live. Basically, whatever is virtue, it's whatever you can get away with. Because the end of life, it doesn't really matter. We all die, we all go to dust, what the hell? So I can do whatever I like as long as I don't get found out. And you've got the other ones, have a soul after the, you know, persisting after death means you have to go to some heaven or hell or something. Or you just have to wander forever and ever and ever and ever. There's no end to it because you can't destroy anything. So those are very important ideas which were prevalent at the time of the Buddha. It's almost like distilling religion and philosophy into these 10 questions. And the last four is this persistent idea, or I shouldn't use the word persistent, it keeps on reoccurring in our world. What happens to an arahat when they die? Where do they go? What happens? You know, is Nibbana, when we first came here about 22 years ago, I remember in Magnolia Street, this little house we had in North Perth, someone coming to see Ajahn Chakra, and I was sitting next to him. I had to stop myself laughing because they said, we believe in Nibbana too. This guy came along and said, and I said, oh really, so you're a Buddhist? And no, we got this other sort of sect, but Nibbana is the name of a planet just beyond Pluto. Where everyone goes once you're enlightened. That's what they said, it's a crazy idea. But this is, where do we want to go? Where do we want to hang our hat when we retire once and for all for this world? Is Nibbana literally the ultimate retirement home? The sunset home which surpasses all other sunset homes of existence? Yes. Yeah. Correct. It applies to each one of us as individuals. The Tathagata literally means one who has gone thus. Basically, one who's disappeared or is disappearing. And it's a beautiful word which describes a Buddha, an enlightened one. But it also will describe an arahat as well. You've gone beyond. Now, what does it mean by gone beyond? Gone beyond what? Have you really gone? Or is, you know, you gone, or actually you go somewhere else? Because gone, even in English, has those two meanings. Gone means, you know, you've gone over there. Or gone sometimes means you've completely gone, disappeared. So what does that gone really mean? Is there anything left? Yes, you say, does it mean that suffering is the end of suffering, that's the state that was gone? Precisely, you, matter, but just a heap of suffering. And when you parinibbana, the suffering is gone. That's all that's lost. Yeah. But now this is a very powerful point. But again, at the end of the sutta, there's a very beautiful simile which explains this. But it's good we're talking about this because it prepares you for the simile. Yes, Bodwin. Okay, you had a Belinda?
The mind.
Correct. Because what is the mind? Is consciousness, the active part of the mind, is dua, is will. So what actually we mean by this word mind? In the Pali here, again, because when I learnt Pali, read all these suttas in Pali, I started with the Vinaya, it's very, very clear that just as these days we use mind, consciousness, even perception sometimes, as synonyms. Actually, we have another word, we have heart. you know, your heart is good, or you've got a good mind, or you've got good consciousness. That is actually used interchangeably today, and it was used interchangeably in the time of the Buddha. Many times you have that which people call mind, consciousness, manovijnana, or citta. Some people think it's eternal, whatever. The point was here, he said, that which people call this, or this, or this. And it was that singular. In Pali, because it's an ancient language, so they distinguish between one thing and two things, a different word. That was referring, the word they used was a singular. That one thing, which sometimes people call mind, sometimes people call consciousness, sometimes people call citta. These were used synonymously in the time of the Buddha. So they're not different words with shades of different meaning. They're the same. And this is what happens to that. What is that first of all now? And what happens to it after enlightenment? That's what those questions are all about. When you're enlightened, where do you go? Do you exist? Do you not exist? Do you go to some in-between state of both existing or not existing? Or what do you do? Yeah. Okay, you're asking the question that sometimes some monks maintain that, say, enlightened beings can come back, they can manifest, they can teach you, and they were saying that it's in contradiction of the suttas, and I will certainly agree with that second point. It is in flat contradiction with the word of the Buddha, and I think it's a misapprehension that anyone can come back. What is actually happening in those monks who say such things is when you understand the world of nimittas, these are not beings which come back. Symbols which we interpret as beings will actually come back to teach you. In the same way that you've probably heard me say this before in retreats, when you get into those jhana states, sometimes those powerful states can be interpreted as union with God. I think I mentioned that even on Friday night, didn't I? Simply because the power of those states, the singleness of those states, much of what you take to be yourself has completely disappeared. You've vanished. The self which you recognize has gone. The five senses, the ability to do things, what I call the potential to do has vanished, and you've got this incredibly powerful, beautiful, pure state. Many people are Christians, Hindus as well, would believe that as union with an ultimate being. Now, why do they do that? It's what we add on to the experience. Now, in the state before, so we enter into those jhanas, or the states afterwards, there again you have a powerful mind, and you get what's called like nimittas can come up. These are not just the beautiful lights. Sometimes it's visions. I've got to be very careful of how much I say about personal experiences, but one of the ones which I figure I'm allowed to say is, now you heard me say this before on the retreats, the early experiences of my early life, these come up as like nimittas, as experiences in the mind. You've got your eyes closed, but you're back being a baby. And this is actually the experience of the mind. You're not a baby, you're a monk, grown up, mature. But you experience it as a baby. There's many other things which can happen as well. In my early meditative experience, Venerable Chulaka reminded me of the experience I had of a nimitta of a demon coming up in front of me. And this demon was so ugly and frightening and terrifying. But I had enough wisdom to know exactly what to do with this demon. He had his big fangs and big bulging eyes. And look, it was really scary. So, just as I used to do when I was at school, I blacked out a few of its fangs to give some holes between its teeth. I put a cigarette in its mouth, like doodling on a picture. And I actually turned the corners of its mouth up so it was smiling. I put some sunnies over its, you know, frightening eyes and a straw hat with a flower on its head. This is what I used to do with pictures at school when I was being naughty. And I knew because this was a creation of my mind, you know, perception adds onto it, it creates things, I knew I could play around with it that way. And it's a very skillful thing to do, because this terrible demon ended up as being a joke. And in my meditation, I just laughed at this stupid demon who was once frightening, who I actually humiliated. And of course, it disappeared. It wasn't a real demon. It was just a product of my mind, as all demons are. And you use that to overcome it. And it went. In the same states of mind, you can get these images of all sorts of things coming up. Many people have actually told me that getting deep meditation, they can actually visualize the Buddha. So what did he look like? And sometimes he looks just like a Thai person. And I have to tell them, I'm sorry, the Buddha was Indian, not Thai. Yeah. Okay, saying there's an image in the museum in Benares, and they say that's an image of the Buddha. That's what they recognize. The story between of that particular image, I think I mentioned it to you when I was there, that was it's a painting in the Royal Palace, Chitlada Palace in Bangkok, and it was a corner of that painting blown up. That is not sort of some manifestation of a Buddha which has actually appeared to anybody on some blank photographic film. That is just a blow-up of a very small part of a big painting. However, we have the power of belief. No one would actually accept that that's actually what it is, because at last we have a picture of the Buddha, and some monks actually blow it by saying, yeah, that's what it really is. The truth is actually quite down to earth. But this is actually the power of belief. If that's what we think a Buddha is, then actually when we do our meditation, we get these nimittas, we'll see that image. And we'll take that as being a Buddha. Some of the images which we have in our nimittas, they are conditioned from our culture, which is why in those deep states of mind, people see devas, angels. All the Thai people who see angels, they see them with these big crowns on top of their head, but without any wings. Christian traditions, if you've been brought up in a Christian tradition, people actually see them with wings on. We see a deva as we expect to see them. And this is actually what happens with seeing, you know, arahats, if you like, coming towards you. This is just the mind, just insights coming, which we clothe in a means by which we can relate it to ourselves with ease. This is profound pieces of wisdom, insights flowing into your mind. And we actually perceive this as like arahats coming. They're not arahats. They're not real beings. Completely mind-made. Okay.
An experience by the meditator as being from some place external. In other words, I haven't thought of this stuff before. It's come out of the blue. It seems to come from this image, this image, or whatever it is out there. Is it possible to have the insight that comes with that?
Yeah, I think. Okay, you're asking sort of that when insights, truths, great revelations, for want of a better word, appear with these images. Now, is it actually a real revelation, or is it coming from within you? It is just the process of insight, just the way that the mind moves to knowledge based on its experience, based upon its deep seeing. When an insight comes up, sometimes even, well, you know that schizophrenics feel they're hearing voices from outside, but those voices we know absolutely for sure, they don't come from anybody. I mean, it's happened several times because I'm a monk, a religious leader. Sometimes people, this one lady once turned up at my monastery. She was from Bentley. She still had the wristband on her. She said that I called her to come to see me. And obviously it's just schizophrenia. But to her, there was no difference. It was as if Ajahn Brahm had talked to her, sort of in her madness. Now that's an extreme case, but there's also the moderate cases, where sometimes we have an insight, and we think that comes from somebody else. It doesn't come from somebody else, it comes from you. Sometimes you hear a little voice. Is that voice coming from someone else? A lot of times it's just coming from you. It's very, very, very rare that that's coming from any other being. It's the same with these arahats. It's coming from within inside. We make a picture of them. You don't trust it. This is the point. And you know what happens when you start listening to voices? Yeah. Yeah. And it gets into... But we're not just voices. Pictures sometimes come up. Now remember, in these deep states of meditation, the mind is very powerful. And it can create many, many things. You've heard me say before that in deep states of meditation, I just use the word, perception grows its wings. You can start to perceive some weird things, things which just cannot exist. When you first get into this, it sometimes can be frightening. But sometimes it's weird. One of the examples which happened to me in my early life as a monk, in this monastery, Wat Nanda Chat, walking past the old bathing place, there's I think it's a kuti there now, the first year or two of Wat Nanda Chat, one of the monks had hung their towel on the line, and it was a black towel, jet black. And I stopped. I don't know any monk who has a black towel. Do any of you have a jet black towel? You don't have black towels. They're all white. Maybe they're red or blue or something, but not black. And it was jet black. And I stood and looked at that for 2 or 3 minutes. What the hell's going on? And after about 3 or 4 minutes, it just flipped into white. And, you know, it made a lot, it was really weird how, you know, you were fully conscious, fully aware, no taking drugs or anything, just meditation. And that was one of the early occasions where the perception could just do those things. The reason why our perception is as it is we're just so heavily trained and conditioned to see things in only one way. And in meditation, we actually take off that conditioning. It's like to take the blinkers off the horse. We can start to see weird things, different ways of looking at things. If you have a good teacher, if you know what meditation is, it's not scary, it can be great fun. You do weird things, and I like weirdness. I'm a disciple of like Calvin, and of Calvin and Hobbes, always like weirdness. These are weird things which happen to you. And it's the same process which creates those images in the mind, which if you're not careful, you can take as a Buddha's coming to you, or Jesus Christ revealing that you're the next Messiah, or God sort of anointing you. And it can happen, it does happen, and the reason is you're actually adding a little bit more onto the reality. It's not exactly like that. That's where all these prophets come from. There's always a new prophet coming along. They get into deep states of mind, and there's something real there, but they add all this other stuff onto it. And it's just not tenable, it cannot happen that any arahat can come back. That just goes completely against the teachings of the Buddha, it goes against the truth, it goes against the reality. And I'm going to say so in a beautiful simile of the Buddha coming up in a few moments. Yeah? Absolutely. Very good, actually, you bring that up. According to the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, and I think it's this story which actually gave rise in Christianity to the temptation of Jesus, but this was actually 500-600 years beforehand, under the Bodhi tree, according to the old stories, the Buddha was actually tempted. And of course, had these Mara's armies come in to fight him. And first of all, it was like, Namara, not with his armies coming, but first of all coming to say, look, you're such a great person, you can be what in Buddhism we call the wheel-turning monarch. In other words, you can be this great leader of the world who could do so much for the whole world, could eradicate poverty, stop all the wars, you know, have a beautiful, wonderful government so that, you know, there would be no one out of work anymore, there would be no sort of, you know, this rich and the poor divide anymore. The whole world would be perfect. You've got the power to do that. And of course, it's very tempting, you know, to fix up the world. But, you know, the Buddha said no. That was his great wisdom. So when that didn't work, and you can see that, you know, everyone has that temptation to actually fix up the world first of all, rather than becoming enlightened. And that was one of the first temptation. The other temptation was using fear. Now all these armies trying to destroy your body. And of course, all it really was the fear of losing his body. Death, basically. That's what an army is trying to do to you. And I've mentioned this in the path of meditation. To get into the jhanas, you've got to let go of your body. The whole thing has got to disappear. It is literally a death of the body. Now, how that actually manifests as a nimitta, you literally paint a picture of that process, of the resistance to letting go of the body. And that was like an army trying to kill you and bring up that fear of, my body's disappearing. I can't feel my hands. I can't feel my body. I can't hear anymore. And that would actually have painted a picture, this amazing picture of like Mara in his armies. And there was also like the lust, you know, the desire for sensory pleasures, again, which in the jhanas, to get close to enlightenment, you have to let go of all your five senses. And what is the resistance to the five senses? Fun. You know, having sex, seeing beautiful girls, listening to nice music, you know, having good food. And that was sort of the other symbolism of that temptation. And Mara's, they call it Mara's daughters. Tanha, Arati, and what's the other one? And Tanha, Arati, it was Raga. Just like delight, craving, and lust. And that was just a symbolism. So that was actually the forces acting on the Buddha's mind before going into jhanas, the obstacles he had to overcome. But that's how you'd visualize them. You paint a picture of them to make sense. Correct, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I will confess that when I was in Portland, I saw a movie. And the movie was What the Bleep Do We Know? Because lots of you have been telling me about this movie. And when I was in Portland, apparently that's where it was shot. Because I was taking me to some sort of talk, and I went past the Baghdad cinema. He said, that was actually in the movie. I said, yeah, I always wanted to watch that movie. And so they went to the video store, which is almost 5 minutes afterwards, we'll get it for you, and got it out from the video store, and I saw it there. And apparently in that movie, they maintained that when Columbus came on the shores of, the Caribbean, some island there, so the Indians couldn't see the ships. And said the reason they couldn't see the ships is because that was completely beyond their perception. They just, you know, their eyes could see, but their mind couldn't interpret what those were. And it was actually a reasonable thing. When something is completely beyond sort of your experience, you just haven't got language for it. This is actually a school teacher who, or an educational psychologist would probably agree with that. Even something as big as a Spanish galleon, you look out to the sea, you just cannot see it. The eyes do, but the mind doesn't. Now, this is actually the way that our perception is sometimes limited by our experience. It's great stuff. It's true, but it also, this is what happens in your meditation. You can really sort of expand the boundaries of your mind, and you can see things which other people can't see, which have always been there, but they're beyond your cultural boundaries. Fascinating. It's also why people see flying saucers. And they're absolutely certain they exist. So anyway, let's go back to Vajracchedasutta. but it's great because this is all part of it. Then, this is number paragraph 15. Oh no, just under above paragraph 15. Just a sentence or two before. This is very good. All these views, not only they miss a point, but they are beset by, this is the top of page 592, they are beset by suffering, vexation, thirst, despair and fever. And this is the great point. They do not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion. The other word for dispassion is fading away, viraga. And I prefer fading away here. To disenchantment, to fading away, to cessation, to peace. And peace is where things, again, have faded away. In the same way, your body is finally peaceful when you're not knowing it anymore, when it's disappeared. In meditation, when the body disappears, only then is the body truly at peace. In Pali, it's called kaya prasadi, the tranquility of the body. And then from there, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. As I mentioned on Friday night, when things disappear, only then do you know what they are. Only when water disappears, for the tadpole turned into a frog, can it know what water is. From that peace and disappearance, cessation, peace, then comes knowledge. And after knowledge, enlightenment. And after enlightenment, the end of the life, to nibbana. This is a sequence here. And those views do not lead to that sequence. Eightfold Path does lead to that sequence. The sequence of fading away, ceasing, nibbana. Things fade away, disenchantment, you're not interested in them anymore, not interested in the body, not interested in the senses, not interested in doing things anymore. And if it really is disenchantment, you might even call it detachment, that leads to the whole thing fading away to the point where it ceases and it's all peaceful, and then you understand what it is, the direct knowledge. And from that understanding you get enlightenment. From that enlightenment is the end of rebirth, nibbana. Sequence. It's very important. But anyway, let's go back to 15. Then, does Master Gotama hold any view at all? Vaccha. View here, speculative view, is something that the Tathagata has put away. View, as he put it away. The word is actually ditti here. It's like view. Bhikkhu Bodhi has put speculative view here. It's not a bad translation, but I think the meaning of this word view is actually seen in this sentence. I've just taken off speculative here. I'll just use view. Vaccha. View is the something that the Tathagata has put away. For the Tathagata Vaccha has seen this. So like a view is just something which you take on belief, on faith. And what you've seen, what you've experienced, obviously supersedes that view. So don't have any views. I have knowledge. I have understanding. So this is not the word ditti, view, means something you've taken on faith, something you've worked out for yourself, something which you believe might be true, because you trust other people, it makes sense to you, it appears logical. That's called a view. This is why the Buddha's put those things away, because he doesn't need those anymore. He's got direct knowledge. And what has he seen? Such is material form. This is rupa. The body. Such is its origin, where it comes from. Such is its disappearance. Such is this feeling, this Vedana, such where it comes from, how it just vanishes. Such is perceptions, such is their origin, such as they vanish. Such are volitional formations, including will. This is what will is. This is where it comes from, its origin, not coming from a self or a soul. As you heard me say last Friday, coming from conditions, like advertisements, culture. Even me, I'm conditioning you now. This is where this will comes from. This is where it ceases. Who knows where will ceases? Where does it cease? Yeah, well done. Second jhana and above, will ceases. And this is what you experience. This is not faith. This is what you know. Such is consciousness. Such is its origin. Such is the disappearance of the knowing. This is powerful stuff. This is what the Buddha knows. Therefore, I say, with the destruction fading away, cessation given up and relinquishing, of all conceivings, all excogitations, all eye-making, mind-making, and the underlying tendency to conceit, the Tathagata is liberated through non-clinging. Understands what all these things are, where they come from. Where does this idea of a knower come from? Where does consciousness arise from? This is what the Buddha sees, knows. Because there's no I there, there's no me there, the Buddha is liberated because he doesn't cling to any of these things. Clinging to them means making an I, a me, a mine out of them. That's what clinging means. You define yourself by what you attach to. When you attach to nothing, there's no one left. Now, here we go back again. Obviously, Vaccha is not all that satisfied, but he hasn't understood what the Buddha was saying, because he asks, when a monk's mind is liberated thus, Master Gotama, where does he reappear after death? In other words, he's asking the same question. What happens to a Tathagata after they die? Now, this is where the Buddha gets really clear on this. The term reappears does not apply, Vaccha. Then he does not reappear, Master Gotama. The term does not reappear does not apply, Vaccha. Then he both reappears and does not reappear, Master Gotama. The term both reappears and does not reappear does not apply, Vaccha. Then he neither reappears nor does not reappear, Master Gotama. The term neither reappears nor does not reappear does not apply, Vaccha. Oh my goodness, when Master Gotama is asked these four questions, he replies the term reappears does not appear, does not apply, does not reappear, does not apply, both reappears and does not reappear, does not apply, neither reappears nor does not reappear, does not apply. Here I have fallen into bewilderment, Master Gotama. Here I have fallen into confusion, and the measure of confidence I had once gained through previous conversations with Master Gotama has now disappeared. That's why I like these suttas, so you can read, you can understand what's going on. It is enough to cause you bewilderment, Vaccha, enough to cause you confusion. For this Dhamma, Vaccha, is profound, hard to see, hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle, to be experienced by the wise. It is hard for you to understand when you hold another view, accept another teaching, approve another teaching, pursue another training, and follow a different teacher. Literally, your perceptual framework stops you from seeing. So the Buddha has to make a different perceptual framework in order for him to understand what's going on. And that's what I've been trying to do. And now we get the killer here. Beautiful, simple simile which gives the name to this sutta on fire. What do you think, Vaccha? Sorry. So I will question you about this in return, Vaccha. Answer as you choose. What do you think, Vaccha? Suppose a fire were burning before you. Would you know this fire is burning before me? I would, Master Gotama. Quite clear. If someone were to ask you, Vaccha, what does this fire burning before you burn in dependence of? Being asked that, what would you answer? Being asked that, Master Gotama, I would answer, this fire burning before me burns in dependence on the fuel of grass and sticks. I don't know if you have that there, but that fuel is actually missed out in the translation. I added it in there. It depends on the fuel, literally the upadana, of grass and sticks. If that fire before you were to be extinguished, you know what the word for extinguish is? Nibbana, yes. Nibbayaya is the verbal form. Would you know that the fire before me has been nibbuto, extinguished? The same word for the Buddha said when nibbutomhi, I am extinguished, when he said he was enlightened. Would you know that this fire before me has been nibbanaed? I would, Master Gotama. If someone were to ask you, Vaccha, when that fire before you was nibbanaed, to which direction did it go? To the east, to the west, to the north, or the south? Being asked that, what would you answer? That does not apply, Master Gotama. The fire burned in dependence on its fuel of grass and sticks. When that is used up, it does not get any more fuel, any more upadana. Being without fuel, it is reckoned as extinguished, nibbanat. So too, Vacha, the Buddha has abandoned that material form which one describing the Tathagata might describe him. He has cut it off at the root, made it like a palm stone, done away with it, so that it is no longer subject to future arising. The Tathagata is liberated from reckoning in terms of material form. He is profound, immeasurable, unfathomable, like the ocean. The term reappears does not apply. The term does not reappear does not apply. The term both reappears and does not reappear does not apply. The term neither reappears nor does not reappear does not apply. What it means there is very clear. It's just like the fire having abandoned or the fuel run out, then of course it's extinguished. So the Buddha does not think of himself as the body or anything to do with the body. He's not measured by the body, cannot be thought of as a body. That's what it means by liberated from the body. The Tathagata has abandoned that feeling which by which one describing the Tathagata might describe him. He's not measured himself by feeling, by the pleasure and pain. He's abandoned perception. He's abandoned those formations and will by which one describing the Tathagata might describe him. The Tathagata, one who chose to ordain monks or chose to make all these rules for the nuns. Or the Tathagata was the one who decided to go and walking and spread the Dhamma through India. This is not the Tathagata. You can't define him, a Buddha, by the will. That's just volitional formations, that's all. So he doesn't measure him by his will. No more you measure yourself by your choices. Do you measure yourself by your good choices and bad choices? How smart I am to have chosen to come here today and listen to this sutta. How stupid I was. I lost my reading glasses while I was in New York. Stupid thing to do. But do you measure yourself by your choices? Well, Buddha doesn't. Yes, good, yeah. That's what I mean by I am the one who decided on this. I didn't decide upon this. And the Tathagata has abandoned, what is it? Is liberated from reckoning from consciousness. He's abandoned it. He's profound, immeasurable, unfathomable like the ocean. So the term reappears of consciousness. Okay, now, here we go. I missed a bit. The Tathagata has abandoned that consciousness by which one describing the Tathagata might describe him. He's not the one who knows. He's abandoned all consciousness. He has cut it off at the root, made it like a palm stump, done away with it, so it is no longer subject to future arising. In that sense, the Tathagata is like the Terminator. He is, like the Terminator. Terminated all the five khandhas. The Tathagata is liberated from reckoning in terms of consciousness. He is not the knower. He's liberated from reckoning in such terms. Profound, immeasurable, unfathomable like the ocean, the term reappears, does not apply, does not reappear, does not apply. The term both reappears and does not reappear, does not apply. The term neither reappears nor does not reappear, does not apply. This is what we actually mean. So, does the Tathagata appear? Does the Tathagata persist after death, not persist after death, both persist and not persist, neither persist nor not persist? The terms do not apply. In the same way, when a fire goes out, does it exist afterwards or not exist? Both exist and not exist? Neither exist nor not exist? Once the fuel is all used up, it does not apply. Why doesn't it apply? Because the fuel is defined, the fire is defined according to its fuel. The other simile which the Buddha often used, like an oil lamp, you have a flame, and the flame burns independently, it exists. Independence on the wick, the oil, and the heat. And if any of those three causes, any of those three upadanas is taken away, the wick is all used up, the oil is used up, or the wind blows the heat away, only one of those causes is removed, what happens to the flame? Where does it go? Does it go to the ground of all flames? This wonderful flame heaven called Nibbana, just beyond Pluto. What happens to flames? It does not apply. This is what the Buddha is saying here. Exactly. Because all consciousness, the word actually vijnana, the V in front, jnana, you know Ajahn Jnana Dhammo? Jnana means wisdom, knowing, wise. And vit is the same as our English bi. You know, like bifocal, bipeds, bicycle, it means two of something. What it's actually saying there is that to know it always has to be, even discriminate, the dis means two. You know, like diameter what's the other word? Dichotomy, two sides. It always means two also. I think that's the Greek word for two. Bi is like the Latin, coming from the Sanskrit. What it means, you have to have two things in order to know. You have to have dark in order to know light. You have to have happiness to know suffering. This is consciousness always has to have two things. If only has one thing, it disappears, turns off. That's actually why we meditate. One focus of the mind, things start to disappear. That's why if you have the same sound outside, after a while it disappears. There's no contrast. There's no two. In non-duality, things disappear. So, the only way you can have consciousness is to have suffering and happiness. That has to happen, to have consciousness. Consciousness demands having both. The only way to overcome suffering is to get rid of consciousness altogether. When consciousness ceases, happiness and suffering both cease. That's why the Buddha says, the only thing I talk about is suffering arising, suffering ceasing. When this was said, the wanderer Vajragota said to the Blessed One, Master Gotama, suppose there were a great sala tree not far from a village or town, and impermanence wore away its branches and foliage, its bark and sapwood, so on a latter occasion, being divested of branches and all the leaves, divested of all its bark and sapwood, it became pure, consisting entirely of heartwood. These sala trees are very, very strong hardwood. So all you've got there is just this hardwood tree. And all the other rubbish, like the leaves and the bark and the twigs, it's all disappeared. Just this beautiful hardwood standing in the forest. So too, this discourse of Master Gotama's is divested of branches and foliage, divested of bark and sapwood, and is pure, consisting entirely of heartwood. So no other rubbish, just really straight to the point. And magnificent Master Gotama, Master Gotama has made the Dharma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. I go to Master Gotama for refuge and to the Dhamma and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus. From today let Master Gotama remember me as the lay follower who has gone to him for refuge for life. So obviously he understood enough about that to say, right, I'm not just interested in you anymore, you are now my teacher. This is where Vajragota became a disciple of the Buddha. And that's a powerful deep sutta all about the nature of the self. And the answer to the question, what happens to an arahat after they die? There was no one there to begin with. That's why cessation can happen. As I said on Friday night, if there was something there, you can't destroy something. You can only change its form. Only if there's nothing there can you have nothing afterwards. The only way this world, this physical universe, could have arisen out of nothing is if there was nothing here now. And that was a talk on Friday night. Any scientist would know there is nothing here. It's just full of holes. Holes all the way. Which is why we call this the holy life. Thank you. Okay. nice way to end. Okay, so thank you for listening. Hopefully you're all enlightened. Let's say the... because it's... What time is it? I can't see the clock there. 4:19. Only 4:19? Oh, we've got another 10 minutes. Anyone want to ask another questions before we finish off? Suffering. Eternalism implies eternal suffering.
But it also implies some substance which goes on eternity.
Yeah.
What you're saying is the Buddha talks about emptiness, which is in the present. And so it's not applicable to say that there is something that exists in time off the future, back to the past.
Correct. Yes, Ainsley. Yeah, consciousness has to have a counterpoint, yes. Okay, you're asking where consciousness goes as far as name and form and turns back upon itself. That's in the Mahanidana Sutta, Digha Nikaya. What that really means is when the Buddha was looking at sort of the causal sequence, finding out where things come from, why they come into existence, and seeing it's like the flame comes from the oil, the heat and the wick, where does this consciousness come from? And he said consciousness actually comes from name and form, which originally meant the objects of consciousness. The age of the Abhidharma changed all these things, and they'd had these really weird and actually inaccurate descriptions of what name and form is. They defined it completely differently. And many Abhidharma people with influence in the Abhidharma, you know, they actually, name and form also includes consciousness, but it obviously doesn't. It's very clear from the suttas it can't. But what name and form means, it's the objects of consciousness. So the knowing has to depend upon the known. The known depends upon the knower, or the knowing. Correct, yes. It's just you're looking at it from two different angles. One, you can say it's a knower. The other thing is what's known. But that's just a way of spitting out what is usually one entity, just from two angles. It's just a matrix which we impose upon reality for our ease of understanding, which does not really... It misses the unity of the knower and the known, and how they depend and influence each other. It's very clear you cannot have consciousness without an object of consciousness. This is actually what you experience. This is what happens in the immaterial jhanas. Basically, you take away the objects of consciousness. You know, first of all, unlimited or unmeasured or basically no space, and then consciousness, which depends upon space, just vanishes. And then you've got the object then is consciousness, infinite, unbounded consciousness, which basically means no consciousness. And that turns off the consciousness, and then you have nothing as your object. But you're perceiving nothing, the third immaterial state. Because you actually, the object is nothing, but there's still perception there. Perception turns off. But then you're perceiving the perception's turned off, which is neither perception nor non-perception. The non-perception part is the object. Perception part is the subject sort of thing, but they're really one. All that's happening is because of stillness, the mind is just turning off. It's disappearing, and after that is cessation. Okay, yeah, the ignorance and karma formations, but that is actually included in the craving part of the an upadana, part of the dependent origination, because it's those two together. And you crave because we're deluded, because we think it's mine. That's why we crave. Well, not really, because it's just another way of looking at it. It's almost like at craving. You can either branch back through feeling, or you can branch into karma formations, which is craving. And into ignorance, delusion. But, yeah. What's the point of of identical twins? Is just the same body, the same. It's like a clone. It is a clone, I think. It's the same as a clone, but it's just streams of consciousness. You know, the process from previous lives carries on. One goes into one body, one goes into the other body. They're separate personalities. Correct. Yes. Obviously, that because they're in the womb together, they've obviously got a connection from the past, a very close connection. They may have actually been identical twins in previous life. I think that's very feasible. You know, so close to each other, they get born in the same womb together. But most importantly, they've got the same conditioning together, which means that much of their character, their conditioned character, is very similar. Yeah, genetically they may be identical, but sort of identical twins. But as everybody knows, that even in Siamese twins, they're completely different characters. And was it? Remember this one Siamese twins, one liked to smoke, the other one hated it. But, you know, when one smokes, the other one gets cancer as well. It's not really fair. Oh, yeah. Yeah, when you're saying Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who wrote a book and about her life, the most important thing is love. But that begs the question of what that love really is. And there's a love which is attachment, and there's a love which is freedom. And it's a freedom love which I wanted to encourage. A love which frees. In other words, when someone's about to die, you let them go. You don't cry. You love them, so you liberate them. You love your mind so much, you liberate it, you stop being a control freak. The sign of love is the disappearance of craving. Yes, well actually it's you let go of everything. Metta is loving kindness, door of my heart's open, which means you don't change anything. You love everybody for who they are. You love Osama bin Laden. For who he is. Can you do that? So love is very difficult. The love which liberates sends you hurtling out of samsara. Love is where you end. Hatred is actually what makes yourself grow. That's why people get into hatred and anger, because they feel they are somebody. Bigger ego. In love, you surrender and disappear. You fade away. Yeah. Yes, very good. Excellent, yeah. For the tape, you were with a lady and she was mentioned that 2 years ago her son died, and as soon as she said that she started crying. She asked you, where did that feeling come from? And you said, from her ego. Great answer. See? The ego itself, the ownership, myself, my son, and the my is a problem. Why do we cry about our son died, but other people's children may die in more tragic circumstances for that, and it doesn't. We feel a little bit sad, we don't weep. It's the ownership that is cause of suffering. And why do we do that? Because we like to own things. That builds up our sense of being somebody, ego. That's why in our society, the bigger the house, the more property you have, the more money in the bank, the more you exist. When you haven't got anything, like us monks, we're literally off the record of the government. We got no marriage certificate, no social security number, no tax file number. No, in many ways, we vanished. The less you own, the more you disappear, both physically and also in the heart. It's in a passport, but it's disappearing. It's nearly all used up. I have to get a new one. Okay, so that's the thank you for the extra 10 minutes. Now we'll pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and then we'll go home.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi suvākkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi suppatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sango Sankhang Namami.